Hi, everyone. This is Josh Nason, and this is Josh Nason's Punch-Out here on WrestlingObserver.com. I'm a writer, editor, and podcaster for the website, past writer for Bloody Elbow, Fight Magazine, Bleacher Report, and a bunch of other websites that no longer exist. Hope you guys are having a great week. We are battling a snowstorm, as seems to be the case almost every single week, every other week here in the Northeast. But it's fitting, because UFC's in town, right? UFC 220 coming up Saturday night from the TD Garden, co-headlined by Volkan Ozdemir versus Daniel Cormier for the light heavyweight championship, but also the big daddy, the heavyweight title, Stipe Miocic, finally returning after a long absence, defending against the fast, up-and-coming, next big thing, Francis Ngannou. Should be an awesome heavyweight title fight. The rest of the card is kind of but we'll get to that a little bit later on. So helping me talk about this card, but really what the show is about, and actually two shows, is the history of UFC in Boston. And originally I wanted to do this because, again, I'm from the region, and I found that there's a lot of interesting things that have happened throughout the course of UFC's history here. Obviously, Dana White being from the area, that plays into it. But, I mean, there was, if you think back to the very first event with the first ever boxer versus UFC fighter event that happened in the cage. You know, we talk about Mayweather and McGregor in the boxing ring, but obviously back in the day, James Toney came to the UFC to fight, and he fought Randy Couture in Boston. This was the UFC's very first show in the city, and there was also the Fox Sports 1 debut show was actually in Boston as well. Conor McGregor, two fights here. We got to see his rise along the way. His very first main event was in Boston. So there's a lot of different things that have happened, a lot of kind of just little pebbles between the big rocks, so to speak. So help me uncover all this is friend of the show and a New England guy, Boston guy, Jack Encarnacio of the Boston Herald. You know, from Sure Dog and obviously the Laps fam. So originally I was thinking, maybe we'll go an hour, hour 20. We went 2 hours talking about all these different shows in the history of the UFC, because you get to talking and Jack is so great with all these just different details and things that he remembers, little things that you'll hear along the way that I completely forgot about. So we actually, this is going to be a two-part podcast. So part one today is going to focus on a little bit of kind of how the UFC and MMA got legalized, some fun notes about some shows in Worcester, Massachusetts that were not UFC related that kind of play into the history of the sport in the state. And then we launch into UFC 118, which is back in August 2010. And we then go to, let's see, this was the FS1 show that was next. I'm actually bringing up my notes right now. Yeah, so August UFC 118, August 28th, 2010, we start there. That's where everything kicks off. And we go to, yes, UFC Fight Night, Shogun versus Sonnen, August 17th, 2013. And this was the show headlined by Sonnen versus Mauricio Shogun Hua. Conor McGregor was on the show against Max Holloway. And this was, again, the debut on FS1. So this was a really kind of big time in the sport. There's four events that have happened over the course of UFC's run in Boston. Saturday will be number 5. So again, this part one, we'll be talking about the first two shows, a little bit about the history, and then part two, which will drop on Thursday, will be the UFC Fight Night, which is headlined by McGregor versus Dennis Seaver, and we'll talk about the UFC Fight Night, Dillashaw versus Cruz, and then a little bit about Saturday's show, and away we go. So this is really fun. Again, if you're thinking, why do I care about the UFC's history in Boston? Trust me, you guys will enjoy this quite a bit, and I think you'll really, really like it, because this was a fun conversation. So without further ado, let's get to part one of our two-part conversation with Jack Encarnacio about the history of UFC in Boston. Enjoy. Everyone knows by now that Boston, New England especially, is the center of the sporting world, and no further evidence of that than coming up this Saturday night. UFC 220, Boston, Massachusetts, the Octagon returns to the greatest sports region in the world. Tom Brady, step aside. David Ortiz, get out of here. Forget you, Kyrie Irving. It is time for UFC, and helping me break down this, look at the show a little bit, but also, more importantly, take a look back at the history of the UFC coming to Boston. So a lot of interesting things happened and all kinds of good stuff. Jack Encarnacio, Boston Herald, Sure Dog, all kinds of other stuff in the past. Laps fan, of course, returns. And Jack, what's good? What's happening?
Feeling pretty good, man. Yeah, no question that probably, let's be honest, because Dana White grew up in the city, they've brought big cards to Boston with a little extra sizzle over the years. Always, I don't know, always a little extra effort, it seemed, to be put into the cards they bring here. And it's coalescing again around this double title fight headliner. But yeah, a ton of memories because, you know, when the UFC first hit it big and got sanctioned, of course, in California, before that in Nevada, some of the larger jurisdictions, it took quite a while for them to get cleared in Massachusetts. So there was a lot of pent-up idea of what it would mean when Dana could bring the UFC to his home city, and we're kind of on riding the wave of that coming up Saturday.
Well, as I was going to say, Jack, this is our fucking city, as David Ortiz said in UI. And to use a word that the aforementioned Dana White uses. And yeah, and I think that's kind of where we begin here. So we go back, so kind of to set the stage, November 2009, Massachusetts legalizes MMA. Governor Deval Patrick signed that bill. It had been talked about, obviously, for quite some time. And finally, in November, the pen was put to paper and we are good to go. And there have been some, I was quoting this Mike Chiappetta piece for Bleacher Report, I believe, or actually it was MMA Fighting at the time. He says, quote unquote, Massachusetts boasts a thriving MMA scene as home to fighters, including Kenny Florian, Gabriel Gonzaga, and the Lauzon brothers, Joe and Dan. Not exactly a who's who of MMA talent when compared to some of these other regions. But I think what, you know, if I kind of look back to almost 10 years ago, There was a lot of regional events. I remember covering some shows like in New Hampshire, and obviously there was some stuff going on in Massachusetts, and obviously Connecticut was pretty big at the time. But you know, it was kind of like just an inevitability at this point that the MMA was going to be legalized and UFC was going to come and do a big show. What do you remember? Obviously, this is a long time ago. Do you remember kind of what you thought or kind of the circumstances surrounding finally getting this thing legalized and what it meant?
Yeah, it was a long process actually, because there was a formidable regional scene. There were, you know, a handful of players promoting shows at nightclubs and venues like that. There were some big mainstream media dust ups when they booked an event right outside Fenway Park back in 2005, I want to say. And then there was licensing board action by the city of Boston. They moved the show to two or three other cities in Massachusetts before it could go down. And then you began the whole whack-a-mole process of local boards trying to keep it out of their town and their city and keep themselves out of the headlines. So it went through that whole growing pains period, and that was interesting to watch. At the time, Massachusetts Boxing Commission, which of course had been constituted, had agreed, not by any kind of law or change in regulation or anything formalized on the books, to attend fights, to oversee fights, but not necessarily to regulate them in the kind of full-bodied way we're accustomed to athletic commissions regulating MMA today. They just sort of oversaw things and, of course, wiped their hands completely clean. If anything controversial happened, they would cite their lack of jurisdiction for not being accountable, and they would cite their jurisdiction to get in and kind of push people around and decide what could and couldn't happen and kind of crack some whip. So it was a very odd legal structure in the mid and early 2000s. And this is a time when, you know, of course, the UFC wasn't on cable television as far as free television. There wasn't really a way to see the UFC unless you caught one of those very random Fox Sports Net shows that they had during the Best Damn Sports Show period era in your 2002 time frame, 2003, 2004. There really wasn't a reliable UFC free television presence. And obviously, there was just a smattering, maybe 4 to 5 pay-per-view cards every year, if we can remember those days and believe that. So if you were into mixed martial arts, there was a lot of opportunity to promote locally and really move tickets and fill that pent-up demand between UFCs and of course those who looked in on Pride events over web streams or when they came on DirecTV, which was the only way to buy them back in the 2000s when they ruled the mixed martial arts roost. But There was a much more vibrant scene. I mean, the scene is still vibrant today, but it's much more of like a feeding ground, amateur-style circuit where, you know, prospects are cutting their teeth, honing their craft. There's not quite the local superstar, local hero kind of role to fill anymore, where you really move substantial tickets and come to personify your region and gyms in your region. Now it's just much more, you know, two or three your first two or three pro fights coming out of the region, or you know, you're on the circuit for a while and you get a late call up like Calvin Cater, who will be on the main card on Saturday. I mean, he's been fighting in and around New Hampshire. He's a promoter as well, owning one of the more prominent mixed martial arts promotions that is up at Rockingham Park in New Hampshire, as well as shows in Massachusetts. So it was a fascinating time because the commission, like I said, was there kind of in spirit, but if they wanted to get involved in controversies, they did. Ultimately, though, you know, Mark Ratner worked his magic, the UFC's VP of Regulatory Affairs and the former executive director of the Nevada Commission, legendary Nevada Boxing Hall of Famer regulator that the UFC famously hired in 2006. And he started checking off states on the map, came out here, wined and dined folks. I remember looking at the lobbying record, spent a few nights at one of the pricier hotels in Boston for sure, and hired the right people in terms of working the halls of Beacon Hill, and got the state legislature and a senator, last name Timilty, if I recall, senator or representative, to put the bill to the floor. And it wasn't really much in the way of kickbacks. You know, it was pushbacks, I should say. Kickbacks are kickbacks. Something quite different. Let me say pushback. Thank you. And it was pretty smooth sailing. I mean, you know, states had already taken the plunge. We're talking, like you said, 2009. Some of the largest jurisdictions had cleared and a lot of the hysteria had passed. So, yeah, that was great. And then the question was, when are they coming and where will they go? And I remember Dana White floating in an interview with me, actually, back in 2008, I believe, when it was in the works, when the law was in the works, that they were going to go to Fenway Park, and everyone lost their shit about that. And he promoted, he teased that, I should say, a few more times. Obviously, it never happened. He, in general, is very jittery about outdoor shows, though I'm sure that's relatively low on the list of reasons that that hasn't happened. But yeah, ever since then, it's been they've really embraced with arms wide open. They've got a sold out house Saturday at a time when they can't always sell out a pay per view. I'm not sure this lineup sells out T-Mobile Arena, so it's good to see.
Certainly is. And a couple things there. Fenway has always been floated out there, but I think logistically, I mean, obviously they're doing a lot of other events there. And I think now it would not be out of the realm of possibility. But I think, yeah, you're right with the, you know, skepticism about outdoor shows, even though they've run some successful ones. I think regionally, you know, the bring in the amount of fans you would need to make that a financial success. I think that's one thing. I think the experience as far as sight lines and, you know, the seats are bad enough for a baseball game. I can't imagine sometimes, you know, some of the viewing angles, perhaps for a UFC event. Obviously the visuals, you know, sitting on the monster, those type of things would be cool. But you know, I just realistically don't think that will ever happen. The other thing in kind of looking through this, and this will be the UFC's fifth event in the state of Massachusetts coming up, and they've done with the other four, they've all been always been in TD Garden. They have not explored, you know, like Worcester, for example, with you know, the DCU Center, or you know, Lowell to an extent with, and obviously Lowell is probably not as much a TV friendly arena and a TV ready arena as other ones, but some of the other regions or other venues around the state or arenas, they haven't even bother to even try, maybe the Aganis in Boston or something else smaller. It's always been the Garden. That's been it. And I was kind of surprised that maybe in Worcester, considering that the, I believe it's about 11,000-12,000 or so that can see it, it's a pretty big arena.
Yeah.
I'm surprised that, you know, and I keep thinking of like New York, and this is one of the things where, you know, and Dana sent out the tweet after this got legalized. He mentioned, you know, New York is next, and obviously that would be years before that would happen. But they were kind of like tied in a lot of ways. These are like the last two big gets in the ocean that they wanted to fish for. And, you know, that obviously New York, they did, you know, a show in Buffalo. They did, you know, Nassau. They've done some other, you know, other shows other than Madison Square Garden, but they've never really ventured outside the TD Garden, and really not sure why that is.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, it's something that just came to mind when you mentioned Worcester, which, you know, any wrestling fans listening will certainly know. WWF has run the building for years, and huge things have happened there, including Mick Foley's first WWF title win on that Raw taping, things like that. And so Worcester is actually a city that is, I think, known to wrestling fans who might not be from this part of the country. But in fact, the UFC with its premier card here in August of 2010, was beat to market, so to speak, by two events. One, a live Bellator event that was held at a theater in downtown Boston. Back when Bellator was on that theater tip, it was running the Chicago Theater, and it had kind of a deal with a consortium of theaters. And it was actually, and I went to that, it was Eddie Alvarez versus Josh Neer, and they set the cage up on the stage, and press row was on the other side of the cage. So behind you, you had a curtain, and on the other side of the cage, you had the people. And it was a unique setup. I remember it well. And that came to town before. There was obviously an arms race on once Massachusetts cleared and games were being played about who would be first to market, so to speak. And Bellator came here before that UFC event. And as did Moosin,
yes,
mixed martial arts.
Speaking of Worcester,
which you might remember as the Marius Pudzianowski versus Tim Sylvia match. Tim Sylvia, of course, a Mainer and former UFC heavyweight champion, but outside of the UFC at the time, post the Affliction collapse. And took that payday and went out there and fought the Polish strongman in a hilarious affair. And it was one of the most bizarre nights of mixed martial arts you'll ever see, financed by a shadowy South Korean financier who went only by Mr. O, and who I believe was in attendance that evening but cannot confirm, did not establish visual confirmation of such. But a true cast of characters on hand that night. Roxy Modafferi, the future UFC women's title challenger, in action that night before she hit the national spotlight. I remember Travis Luter and Rafael Natal fought on that night. So that was in Worcester. And I remember they did a substantial turnout for Pudzianowski. You know, it kind of was a head-scratcher why you'd bring Pudzianowski, the Polish strongman and MMA superstar in that country, to here. But I realized that there is a very pronounced, appreciable Polish population in some of the cities in Connecticut that border Massachusetts. And I'm there, and there was just a huge Polish turnout with Polish colors, Polish flags, Polska this, Polska that, Polish language newspapers sitting around. And you kind of saw the wisdom there in terms of picking this market. So you think that would be an opening. But they haven't even gone to the Dunkin' Donut Center in Providence. They've never been to Rhode Island, as a matter of fact. And Rhode Island, with CES, Classic Entertainment Sports, which airs on Access, has one of the richer traditions. They go back even further to a league called Rhode Island Valley Tudo, which was basically bare-knuckle proto-MMA 1998-1999, where Tim Sylvia, George Rivera, in fact, Tim Sylvia fought George Rivera, if you can picture that in your mind's eye, can see the weight differential. And, you know, your classic tape fist, no gloves, NHB-era fights out here. Rhode Island was also where they staged the bare-knuckle brawl between Kimbo Slice and Boston police officer Sean Gannon, one of the first viral videos that led to Sean Gannon actually getting one go in the UFC and getting destroyed by Hinkle, Brendley Hinkle. There's a lot of quirky things. I mean, there's no landmark things per se that have happened here besides the UFC cards we're going to talk about, but there is a pretty colorful history here in terms of the sport, finding a little bit of a heartbeat at a time when, you know, it was hardly accepted nationally. In fact, I remember Kenny Florian had his first four fights here, I believe. And of course, he was in the UFC by fight six and was challenging for the title that quickly after going through the first season of Ultimate Fighter. But Dana White was here on vacation. He owns a vacation home in Maine, and he came to fights in Revere, Massachusetts at Club Lido, which was one of the first kind of hot spots for MMA around here. And he approached Florian after the fight. He lost, but he approached him in the locker room and said, "We're doing this show, this reality show. We need fighters to stock up on. You want to do it?" And Florian, despite very serious lack of experience and pretty primitive striking at the time, he was, of course, a jiu-jitsu guy through and through, accepted the opportunity, made it to the finals, and then they had their in, and he was on the main card against Gray Maynard when they finally came here for UFC 118.
That's right. Yeah, and he was at 185 pounds that season, Ultimate Fighter was, if I remember right. So he was, like, way over.
Oh, my God, yeah.
He was
that's just insane. That's why he's one of the only fighters to fight at four weight classes, because of you know, he simply had to make the weights that the show is allowed, but he is hardly a 185er, as we came to see, fighting all the way down at 145 for the title.
So a couple notes. You mentioned that Moosin show. So I was at that show as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was.
I had not met your major acquaintance at the time. That's hilarious.
No, I attempted to approach you, and your handlers pushed me away. I remember that. I think I fell into a row of box of popcorn or something like that. He just things flew everywhere. It was quite a scene. I covered that show. That was for Bloody Elbow, I believe. So a few things, a couple things I remember about that. Obviously, I remember the Polish influence was crazy. The newspapers, I remember those. I remember seeing Boss Rutten backstage, and he was very tan, and it looked like he had eyeliner on. I remember that.
I read, you know, because I was there live, I didn't see the broadcast, but I understand that's one of the most disastrous MMA pay-per-view commentary tracks you'll ever hear.
I don't even know who was the play-by-play guy.
It was him and some no-name guy. It was Boss, but from what I understood, Boss kind of took the broadcast over because of the lack of chops of the other guy, who I think was just, a fly-by-night MMA announcer.
And that show was in a ring, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was.
Oh, wait. I'm trying to remember. I'm going to look it up because now you're making me anxious because I don't remember.
Yeah. While you do that, I have and I also remember, so I was used to covering other sports events, and usually, you know, for professional events, they have some sort of catering. So you have a quick bite to eat. I think they had just cookies, if I remember right. That was, cookies and water. That was about it.
It was in a cage.
It was in a cage. Okay.
Yes, it certainly was. Yep. A circular cage. I see here Pujanowski's meaty visage floundering like a loose fish on the canvas as the maniac hovers over. I also see Butterbean. He was there.
I don't remember that.
What's his face? Rick Bassman, the longtime California indie promoter.
Oh, yeah. UPW.
UPW, Sting, Ultimate Warrior, through to John Cena. That guy. It was also Butterbean's handler in MMA, as well as Tony Holmes' handler in MMA, the formerly known as Ludwig Borga, who fought in UFC once against Randy Couture. He kind of got cut in on that and supplied some talent as well to that memorable night. All that is to say that there was actually quite a lot of activity even before the UFC finally made it here, which I was surprised to see, because you would think Dana White would have his backyard on lock for that kind of distinction. But folks kind of beat him to market. At the time, they were obviously going nuts in terms of expansion. I mean, the UFC was growing exponentially. That was actually their biggest year ever, if memory serves. I think that was the year of UFC 100 and record-breaking revenues. Now, that was 2009, but at a time of tremendous expansion for them. They were just tripling their schedule and doing incredibly well on pay-per-view. You know, their basement numbers were double. The pay-per-view basement numbers were double of what they are today.
One other Worcester memory, Dan Severn going for his, he actually got his 100th win earlier. He was on his kind of farewell tour. At the time, he was gunning for, he was in the hunt for 100th, his 100th win. And he came, and his record has since been changed. So this is kind of interesting. Anyway, so he was set to fight it. This was May 2011. Set to fight in Worcester. I remember the show got announced. It was basically just it was Paul Vandale Promotions. The Beast Comes East. Beast Comes East. So it wasn't even like a promotion like CES or anything like that really doing it. It was kind of just like they did this thing, partnered with someone else, and kind of just went for it. And I'm like, why? How in the hell are they playing the DCU Center? And what they did is they used one of the conference halls, the convention center area. So it was like all flat seating. I remember there was just aisles and aisles and aisles of empty seats. So I'm there with my friend Paul, who we were doing this. We did this MMA show for ESPN New Hampshire at the time. Mm-hmm. So we take the drive down there, and I can't remember anything else about this card. But Dan Severn loses in less than 4 minutes to the one and only Lee Bean, who I guarantee probably no one has ever heard of before. He gets hit so hard. It is like, it's one of those things you see. It's like, and I've seen a lot of fights cage side and a lot of fights on TV. It is one of those things where you're just like, oh my God, he may be dead. Like, he went completely flat, and it was just, you knew going in, obviously he was an older guy, and just this no name just completely just turned the lights out and smashed the light bulbs and put him all over Dan Severn's prone body. He was just completely done. I mean, it took like, it was like one of those just sad scenes. He would fight just once more after that in Davenport, Iowa, a year later, so getting a victory, unanimous decision victory. But I remember Worcester for, yes, the Polish power, the other Polish hammer, and then also Dan Severn almost getting killed in front of me, and that was quite a night. So
Worcester, to bring it full circle,
yes,
You know what you'd be shocked to know that you don't remember about Worcester if you covered the Moosin event?
I'd be titillated to know, I think. What do you got?
You, my friend, witnessed Saturday night headliner and reigning UFC heavyweight champion Stipe Miocic in his second professional mixed martial arts fight on the undercard, defeating Paul Berry via second round TKO. Miocic fought that night, and you were there, and you don't remember it.
No, I didn't. Wow.
Isn't that something? I also saw John Jones fight, I think his fourth pro fight, in Wilmington, Massachusetts out here. He just came through. He was still working out of, oh God help me, what was the name of that gym? Bomb Squad out of New York, where Tanner McCrory came from, and yep. They had a moment there. And yeah, he was there and just ripped through a guy. I remember the length of the knees up against the ropes, absolutely no hope for his opponent. And I was right there covering it. So yeah, a couple of those before they were stars flashpoints. Stipe Miocic in action, and he returns to defend the title against Ngannou Saturday.
We'll get to that in a few minutes. So let's start with UFC 118. This was August 28th, 2010. Big event, as noted. This was Dana White's homecoming in a lot of ways, a lot of local media press. Obviously, this is, as we talked about, this is the very first UFC event happening in the state. So this was, you know, again, it was a very buzzy period about the sport. It still felt new. You know, we got the gamut of you know, what basically kind of just introing what UFC was to a region that was very sports smart, but but team sports smart. So you had just an introduction to this traveling violent circus of violence that was coming in. They did this is obviously the Dana White influence. It did the third ever Van Expo. The Van Expos were like a big thing at the time, and that was across town or at the Heinz Convention Center, I believe, if I remember right. So that was kind of a big thing there. And this was I'll go through some notes. And you did not cover this first show, you said, correct?
No, I did not cover the show that night. I actually had to go to a wedding that evening, but I did cover the Faneuil Hall press conference that they did several days out, I should say. That was quite a regal setting. I remember pointing to a bust of John Adams and saying that looks like you, Dana. I got a laugh. That was about the end of it.
Fantastic. I remember that. It was very hot out, and I remember trying to find where the media entrance was and like thinking I had to stand this line with all the plebeians and the ham and eggers. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, God damn it. I'm with a Wrestling Observer. I need to get inside this.
I need to observe the wrestling.
I need to get inside this venue post haste. And finally, I was able to make my way through. I'm like, I'm with media, and finally found someone I was able to get inside. But other things during leading up to fight week. So I went to the open workouts, and those were at the – oh, my God. I cannot remember where the open workouts were. But workouts
– Orient's gym in Brookline, right? Or maybe Delagrati, Sityatong in Somerville?
No. This was maybe this was – what did they call it? Is this a media day?
Peter Welch's gym in South Boston.
No, it wasn't at a gym. It was at a just like a different venue. Where the hell was that? It was like a bigger place. Actually, no, it was at I think it was actually at the Heinz, if I remember it, because they had the cage set up for the Fan Expo. Yeah, it was. I'm pretty sure it was at the Heinz.
That makes sense.
Yeah, so I remember this because this is my second ever UFC event I covered. I went down to. As a tester for this, I actually flew myself down to Charlotte because I had friends that lived down there, and there was an event with headlined by Kenny Florian, speaking of, against Takanori Gomi. And I flew myself down there just so I could get practice on a smaller stage to cover a UFC event, because I had covered sports before, but I had never covered a big, obviously, UFC event. So I kind of wanted to get the lay of the land and all that stuff. So I go into this thing in Boston, these open workouts. And I'm just seeing all these people who I've read and seen before and all this stuff. And I'm just kind of like, I kind of get overwhelmed. And I almost had like a panic attack in a sense. Like, I just kind of get really like overwhelmed. I had to like step away for a few minutes and be like, all right, get a hold of yourself here. You've done this before. It was just, this stuff never happens to me. But for some reason, I was like, I felt like, okay, like I have to be so professional. I have to do this. Stuff that I normally wouldn't worry about or think about. For some reason, I was like, my God, this is like, I'm finally here. I finally arrived. It just kind of all caught up with me at that moment. So I always remember that, Jack, for having almost a panic attack at the open workout. So that was a great way for me to just kick off my UFC 118 fight week.
I can see why you stuck around.
Yeah.
Yeah. It can be overwhelming, in particular when you're grinding on play by play. Like the first few shows I did were IFL shows at Mohegan Sun, back when IFL was still around, and I was doing play-by-play. And oh my God, if you let yourself think too hard about the fact that you have to keep up line by line with what's happening in the ring, it'll overwhelm you, just like you said. I mean, it's not a joke covering a big-time MMA event. It is exhausting. It is nonstop. And you just go. You're working. You are totally working. I mean, you have a great seat and all that, but You don't really sit around and savor it at all. You can't. I mean, unless you want to, you know, just like perform poorly, which, you know, some choose to do. But I can see what you're saying.
Yeah, it was for literally standing around and bullshitting with people and watching guys basically fake their ways, but kind of like loaf their way through workouts. I was like, wow, I'm so overwhelmed. And then it took me like 5 minutes. And I was like, okay, I'm fine again. And I remember talking to Jeremy Botter there. I met him. So it was a chance for me to meet like a lot of people I talk with online. It was like face-to-face real people.
Right.
I remember that from also there was I was talking with Botter and a couple other guys. And then there was a skirmish on the other side of the cage. Errol Helwani was doing an interview for, I believe it was Fan House at the time it was called. And he was doing an interview with James Toney. And there was James Toney got really upset, or his handlers got upset, and like this might have been when they tried to grab Errol's microphone. It was just like a big skirmish. And then I remember Botter a few minutes later saying, James Toney almost tried to fight Errol Helwani. Like it was just kind of like, I'm like, what is going on right now? What have I got myself into? And that was, away we went from there.
James Toney coming through, man. What a spectacle that was. The UFC finally gets their elite boxer into the cage to get taken down and tapped. Randy Couture, the man for the job. And that was another example of what I said earlier about how they always try to seem to add kind of an extra dash of marquee value to the UFC cards. Of course, Edgar and Penn in the main event for the championship and the rematch, and Florian and Maynard, which at the time was an important fight at lightweight. But it was Couture and Toney that kind of put it on the map as one of the more kind of spectator-friendly and kind of like above the norm appealing cards of the year. And he brought a spectacle to town, certainly James Toney. I mean, no promoter has ever gotten more out of James Toney, I don't think, than Dana White did that night. And that's saying something considering how tenured he is in the boxing ring and his stature as a really an all-time great heavyweight boxer. And they played that up well. Couture was the man for the job, shot that low single on the ankle, and it was over in seconds, and he was tapping, and the point was proved. And forevermore, Toney Couture would be the fight cited when we talk about how elite boxers would do in the octagon, and including Floyd Mayweather. I mean, when we talked about Mayweather-McGregor getting into a UFC cage, it's Couture-Toney that serves as the touch point to talk about how it would likely play out. We talk a lot less, of course, about Ray Mercer versus Tim Sylvia.
Tim Sylvia, always coming back like a bad penny. That night, 14,168 packed the TD Garden, 2.8 million at the gate, only about 570,000 on pay-per-view. Obviously, that'd be a very stellar number these days, but I was curious about that. Like, why did it not do so well yet? Frankie Edgar, BJ Penn on the card. Obviously, the Couture-Toney affair. There wasn't a lot else star power-wise, and the reason for that a few weeks earlier was they had this mega event, if you guys remember, Anderson Silva versus Chael Sonnen, the very first meeting between those guys. And that was obviously a huge deal. So definitely, you know, having this follow a few weeks later hurt that for sure. But obviously, as you mentioned, kind of the James Toney effect and everyone kind of knew that Couture was going to have his way pretty easily. He did not seem to be concerned in the least bit. It was just a question of make sure you don't do something stupid and walk into a punch. And Toney had his one shot, as you mentioned. We'll get to that in a second. But some of the fights that we could have seen, or fighters we could have seen, Jack, we had Nate Marquardt versus Husamar Paulsharas was originally scheduled for this show, but it was moved because there was an injury to the main event of a card later on the next month, I believe, with Damian Maia versus Alan Belcher. And Damian Maia got moved to this card instead, taking on Mario Miranda. Terry Etem was supposed to be on this card, fighting against Joe Lauzon. He was out. I was really disappointed that we didn't get a chance to see Phil Baroni, who was supposed to be on this show. He got knocked out, hurt by injury or taken out by injury. And then Jorge Rivera. One of the unfortunate things out of this whole USC run in Massachusetts is he was, if people remember, people probably remember him the most for this, the Bisping rivalry and the spitting and all this stuff as well. He never got a chance to fight on a Boston show. And that was, unfortunate. You kind of look back on this, and then a couple other notes I had here. Dave, this show was so big, Dave Meltzer and Brian Alvarez actually flew out for the show. They didn't come for the—
God damn it.
I know. It's crazy, right? So these, so we met at this, what bar did we meet at? It was a bar, like, right, we did kind of just a meetup, like an observer meetup. It was on the board, like kind of a get-together when people used to do these. And so we met up and we're just kind of like sitting around. So I met Brian Alvarez. I met Brian and Dave for the first time. I've been working for the site for, I think it was probably a couple of years by this point. And so they walk in and Brian says, "Wow, you look just like Brian Danielson." And that was the first time I ever met Brian Alvarez. And so we went upstairs and I talked to Dave a little bit. And it was kind of, my first time meeting Dave. And I didn't want to like just kind of like bum rush him with questions, kind of just some, cordial stuff. So we're sitting upstairs this bar, and this was before the show. I think I had one beer because you obviously don't want to go in, loaded or anything like that. So we're sitting around. Of course, everyone's just asking him random, wrestling questions and so on. And out of nowhere, Dave just turns to me and he's just like, "Josh, what do you think about this Strikeforce show or something like that? What's going on with Strikeforce?" And I'm like, and it like came out of completely nowhere. We got a conversation about that. You could tell he was just kind of like, "I need to talk about something else other than wrestling," kind of getting an MMA mindset. And then in the show itself, I actually sat right next to him on press row. So Dave and I got to kind of see him in action. I kind of kept looking over, like kind of just getting an idea of what exactly he was doing. So he and I were doing, both doing posts for the site at the time. It was, so Dave and Brian came out, and that was, I think Brian was in the stands. He went to the fan expo and stuff. And so, yeah, it was crazy that they flew all the way across the country to go to this show.
Yeah, that says something. I mean, really, people always kind of talked about what it would mean when Dana White got a UFC in Boston. And, I think that buy rate's about right. For all we can talk about Couture and Tony, it only hit to a certain degree in terms of mainstream interest, because as decorated as James Toney is in the boxing ring, he really is only someone that boxing connoisseurs are deeply familiar with. He never really moved the business needle appreciably in his long career. So he had the credentials to say that we're presenting a serious boxer in a UFC fight from a promotional standpoint, but he wasn't a draw per se in the boxing world. So, the kind of marquee value was somewhat limited. But, Edgar Penn was certainly a good fight, a rematch from their fight in Abu Dhabi, which ended controversially with Edgar getting his hand raised, Edgar cementing his status as one of the great lightweights of all time, putting Penn away. Big disappointment for Kenny Florian, as he kind of had that hometown pressure on him, but had trouble dealing with Gray Maynard's wrestling over 15 minutes. And you mentioned Terry Adam falling out of the fight with Joe Lozon. And for Mr. Lozon, I think that was a very favorable outcome, because he ended up being assigned to Gabe Rudiger and putting on the prelim card one of the more epic beatdowns, hometown beatdowns, you will ever see in the UFC or in mixed martial arts. He owned Gabe Rudiger, ate him alive in 2 minutes, 1 second, took him down, swarmed him with grounded pound after pinging him on the feet. And it was just like, it is the perfect encapsulation of what like a galvanizing hometown win looks like. It's kind of, to a much lesser degree, of course, on par with what you saw at the Q when Stipe Miocic knocked out Alistair Overeem to defend the championship, and just how, a lot of things coalesced around people assigning hopes to local fighters in a city that hadn't really had much in the way of UFC, experience and shows and intake. And the way he destroyed Rudiger was just enthralling. It was just cathartic. It was crazy to see how deeply satisfying the circumstances were around that fight, and to see Lozon log that hometown win. And he's obviously gone on to a long UFC career, one of the most tenured fighters on the roster, obviously a favorite of not only Dana White, but erstwhile UFC matchmaker Joe Silva, and a company guy through and through, Mr. Joe Lozon. So that was definitely a flashpoint that night.
I'd worked in pro sports for 6 years, seen a lot of wrestling shows, all this stuff. heard a lot of pops. That was easily top five pop. I mean, when he locked on that submission, that place exploded. And there's not hyperbole. And you know this because that place just went completely batshit crazy. It was amazing. It was one of those things you just sat there. And this followed this horrendous Nick Lentz Andre Winner fight. Oh my God. Andre Winner had some of the worst fights ever. But this was the place needed to be brought alive, and he did this in perfect timing right before the pay-per-view. It was just absolutely just amazing stuff. I'll always remember that from the show. I will always remember when Couture was ready to fight Tony just a few seconds before or ready to go. There was a chant of UFC in the building, and I just remember just looking around being like, this is this, you don't get this at MMA shows where people chant for the sport, you know, the organization.
Well, it's the closest thing they've ever gotten to you'll hear in MMA to essentially what the ECW chant used to be in the mid-90s. You know, it's like, this is our team. This is like, not even the fighter. There's like an identity that we're behind here more than just a particular athlete.
And you mentioned Frankie Edgar defeating BJ Penn in that rematch there. And that was it wasn't really a full action fight. Obviously, BJ didn't really seem to be that motivated that night. It was 50-45 all the way around. But it was a fine ending to a memorable night for many different reasons. The undercard, not really much else of note on this. However, Nate Diaz versus Marcus Davis actually opened up the pay-per-view, and Nate Diaz lit Marcus Davis up, made him bleed. Davis got into it. He hung in there. This was actually fight of the night. And I remember this fight because I remember, of course, you know, what the general sports media has to say about the sport afterward is always interesting. And Mike Felger, who is a big time radio host in the city, he loved this fight. He talked a little bit about the UFC experience and watching on TV, and he absolutely loved this fight. He didn't, of course, big surprise, he didn't love the wrestling on the wrestling card that much. However, he absolutely loved this fight, and it seemed like he was going to like get more into it. And then ever since then, I don't think he's ever mentioned UFC again.
So, another word.
kind of a
side note on Marcus Davis, something I guess of interest. One of Dana White's friends from back in his 20s when he lived out here, went to UMass Boston, famously worked as basically a bellhop at the Boston Harbor Hotel, lived in South Boston, kind of found himself mixed up with, associates of Whitey Bulger, let's say. They kind of, at a certain point, he's told the story, kind of wanted a cut of the gym that he was involved in, the boxing gym, and he famously packed his bags overnight and fled to Las Vegas, where he had spent, obviously, in high school going to school at Bishop, what do they call it out there? Bishop something in Las Vegas with
Bishop Gerton?
Gerton? Bishop Gerton? No, isn't Bishop Gerton in New Hampshire?
Oh, that could be too.
Hold on. Yeah, I was so funny you say that because I was about to say that too, but only because
I just remember that
it's a local school.
The trainer that has the T-shirt is Bishop something.
Gorman.
Bishop Gorman. Got it.
He went there with Lorenzo Fertitta, which is how they kind of forged their friendship. And it paid dividends years later. But anyway, he was out here, and one of his friends at that time working that job, I think he worked with him, and in fact, I'm almost positive, is he had a run as a fight promoter out here. His name's Joe Caballero. And he was managing Marcus Davis, and he actually guided most of Marcus Davis's career. He managed Kenny Florian in his earlier days, George Vera and some others. And Joe Caballero certainly saw to it that Marcus Davis kind of got as many goes in the UFC as you would expect anyone to be given in terms of chances. And, Marcus Davis was a tough guy, but obviously adopted the sport quite late from a strictly boxing background, got cast on Ultimate Fighter 2, was kind of undersized for the weight class he was plugged into, but got plenty of opportunities, his share. And that Caballero relationship with Dana White still plays out to this day. I mean, if Dana even comes out here he came out for Looking for a Fight reality show series he did in Maine last year. He kind of made a television filming out of a vacation out here. And sure enough, right by his side the whole time is Joe Caballero hanging and banging. And that's another thing here. He went into business for himself later and formed what was called World Championship Fighting.
Yes.
You remember that event? That's where John Jones fought. That's where Calvin Kattar fought, who's in the card on Sunday. In fact, Calvin Kattar once did a very memorable entrance on a WCF show, dressed head to toe as Hulk Hogan, coming to the ring as in real American, waving the American flag, Catermania shirts all over the Shriners Auditorium that evening. I brought that up to him before his last fight, and he cracked up because he didn't realize that it was something that stuck in anyone else's mind besides his, but he came off as a big star that night. I always kind of filed away a place for Calvin Kattar to break through on the national stage if he could put the tools together in terms of the fighting, because he's got charisma, he's got know-how, and like I said, he understands the promotional side of the business. I mean, he's owned a promotion and promoted MMA out here for years, so he's kind of a unique cat and worth watching as well. So, little side note on Marcus Davis and Joe Caballero.
And let's see what else happened. Joe Lozon's submission of the night. The scrums were good as well. I remember getting a chance. This is when people just kind of crowded around Dana. We used to hold court after press conferences, and I finally got a chance to ask Dana a question for the very first time. And when he looks at you, I kind of just understood this hold. This was that he has on people. This was the height of Dana's. I mean, maybe the height, but it was close to the height of his popularity. And you know from talking to him, especially if you talk to him in person, there's just this engaging just personality, and he just, you know, he's just interested in you, or at least he gives off the impression.
He knows how to make you feel that way, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So it was just asked one question, kind of gazed at me with those big brown eyes, and I just kind of got lost and have no idea even what I asked him. But it was
this is getting weird. This is getting weird, Josh.
Yeah, it certainly is.
You might want to quit before you're ahead on this whole thing. no, you know what it is? Is he? Let's be honest. This is he's at the peak of his powers. Every word that comes out of his mouth is news, mm-hmm. and to some degree, the cult of personality around Dana White remains the overarching theme of the appeal of this sport. I've always said this. It's like Dana White is like the guy who, no matter what he says, even if people have kind of grown calloused to his occasional carnival barking and have kind of caught him in, you know, a few half-truths, some contradictions over the edge. As time goes by, you can only talk so much before people start to realize that, you know, you kind of change how you feel and what you think and what you say based on circumstances. And there's no concrete principles there, even though you're very good at framing things that way and projecting things that way. Still, even people who think they're above, reading too much into what Dana says and think they've figured out Dana, the truth is that he takes him for a ride every time. They hang on his every word. Everything he says resonates, what's the word I'm looking for? Echoes through the MMA space, unlike anybody else's. He's back on that beat. You saw him do the scrum at the St. Louis card, which I was surprised to see because he's very much dialed down that part of what he does, kind of subjecting himself to the scrums and the random questions and the public scrutiny. I think through the transition to WME, or what's now known as Endeavor, buying the company, I think he kind of, let's face it, it kind of dialed down the degree to which he was engaged into the day-to-day and understanding up and down the card, who was fighting who, how the division stacked up. Of course, they added a trillion fucking divisions anyway, so it's hard for anybody to keep up. But I think he's kind of afraid, honestly, because you hear it a few times that he might even forget who's working for his own company or who fought on a particular night. Every now and then you'll see him in a scrum. Someone will ask a question. You can tell by the look on his face that he does not remember the fight, or at least he doesn't remember the fighter by name. You know, when prompted, and he'll say something like, yeah, you know, everybody looked good tonight. Or, yeah, you know, anytime you have a fighter do this, blah, blah, blah. I'm trying to remember when it was that he was ill. It wasn't a Boston show.
With the Meniere's?
It was a Vegas press conference, and he was basically about to pass out, you could tell. And he stepped down from the dais taking a question. But the breaking point for him as he fought through this was somebody asking him a question about an undercard fight. And he just sat in with the whole, you know, anytime you have a fighter that comes to you know what, guys, you don't want to talk to me. Talk to these guys. And then he just couldn't deal anymore. But you could tell that that's his go-to default kind of pat line when the brain isn't necessarily making the connections it needs to. But, yeah, I mean, I've experienced that too when he's come out here and held court. He runs it. He runs everything to this day. And while, you know, a Conor McGregor might be able to figure out some ways to trump card him along the way, that's very much the exception and not the rule.
A couple other notes before we move on here. I remember, say, again, your first time in the city, UFC credentialed a lot of people. I think there was three rows at press row, if I believe, maybe four, possibly, which is unheard of at this point when it comes to some of these other, you know, non-Vegas cities. I think there might have been three. And I remember seeing these two kids. I think they were from Harvard, or they were very hipster looking. And I remember them reading graphic novels at press row. Not even paying attention to what was going on ahead of them. And they were like a row ahead of me. And I'm like, who are these guys? Like, how did they get credentialed? So you kind of could see where the favor lied. And they also went to the post fight press conference. Really didn't pay attention. I think they were just kind of there just to understand, like, what this thing was and what have you, but they weren't too interested in the action. Bob Ryan was also there.
Who invited the Winklevoss twins?
Yeah, I'd be surprised these guys have anywhere near the Facebook money that those guys have. Bob Ryan.
I remember the Bob Ryan column.
Yes.
This is back when, you know, they'd come to a city for the first time,
yep,
and the major sports columnist in the big Metro Daily newspaper would go sit there and record his curmudgeonly thoughts.
Right. And I remember he wasn't there for the whole show. I remember seeing him leave about halfway through. And, it was no big surprise that column came out. And I'm sure for a lot of the uneducated people, or people that had a predisposition to not liking this type of sport, that they were going to be like, okay, Bob Ryan said it and I'm good. And I respect him for a lot of reasons.
All time great sports writer. Yeah.
But he just wasn't into it. And I don't think going into this, I don't think he was this UFC is not for a guy like Bob Ryan. It just isn't.
Yeah. Yeah. They would, UFC would actively court people with his kind of cachet in the sports market. They would try to get the leading sports columnist in major cities to come to the shows, and just, you know, Dana would sit there and chat them up throughout the fights and try to fill in holes and gaps in knowledge and understanding and, yep, you know, try to, you know, deflect attention away from the lesser parts of the sport, or be there to offer a quick explanation if things got kind of stomach churningly violent. But I'm not sure how it went between Dana White and the great Bob Ryan that night, but no, he did not come away writing an article that indicated he was very impressed. And in that vein, one might also know, and this is not quite Boston, but one of Bill Simmons' great all-time pieces was for ESPN when he went to UFC 35 at Mohegan Sun in 2002. And you got it, if you could find that piece. What was it? Used to be called Page 2, right?
Yeah.
Is that what they used to call it there? Yeah. That's one of his breakthrough pieces. Just the same thing, just kind of stream of consciousness. And of course, Bill Simmons, a Boston guy, just recording what it's like to observe the hijinks just in the crowd at a UFC event, particularly at that rough and grit time. So check that out as well.
Sodom Gomorrah in the UFC?
Is that what it's called? Yeah, I think so. That rings a bell. What was it? Was it Rico Rodriguez and who's in the main event? Was that the Rico Randy fight? I think it was.
That I don't know, but yeah, it's still available. Yeah, if you do a search for UFC Bill Simmons, this still comes up. Yeah, September 27th in Connecticut. Imagine that. I have not read this in a long time. Jay Bug is referenced. You know what it's going to be.
Oh, he was. That's Bill Simmons at the height of his powers. If you don't understand like why Bill Simmons became such a big deal, it's because that kind of work. I mean, just tour de force, hilarious, awesome observational writing about sports. And
I actually talked with him a few minutes about UFC backstage at a Celtics game once. And this was during the Rampage Rashad season of Tough. And I think I remember that column. And a friend of mine, of course, the guy's name is Sully, my friend, which everyone seems to be named in Boston at one point or another, said, oh, yeah, he writes about the UFC. And so we talked about that for a few minutes. And his interest was fleeting at that point. He kind of understood. I think he knew a little bit of what was going on with the – because that Rashad Rampage season of Tough was so great.
Yeah.
But other than that, he just says just – I can't remember what he said specifically. But I think he was just kind of like, it's just a lot. You know, it's a lot of stuff. So he knew a little bit about it and was following kind of the big stories as opposed to obviously getting involved the minutiae or anything like that. And he's talked about MMA and UFC a little bit over the years, especially you know, as he as relaunched ringer Chuck Mendenhall doing some stuff there. So it holds a place in his heart, but it's a very small place.
Well, I think he's one of those guys, and any listener of the site will know this. he's one of those guys that read every wrestling word in the Observer and just a couple of paragraphs of the MMA stories. Right. You know, that's kind of his deal.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember at this show, I got home at 3:30 in the morning and vowed to never drive home after a UFC show that late again, which would come a few years later, Jack. And this would be 3 years after UFC debuted. It was a long time. They returned back, and we talked about big shows. This was a big show. August 17, 2013, Chael Sonnen versus Shogun Hua. This was big because this was the launch of FS1, Fox Sports 1, officially kicking off the sports network with a very big show. This was a show that was not, I guess, major on star power when it comes to like a pay-per-view headline or anything like that. However, you look up and down this card, this is interesting names. This is guys that are still making waves in the sport, guys that have moved on, still making good money. And you had this guy on the prelim card who was really kind of the toast of the town all week, but you could tell that the UFC knew that they had something. He was involved in all the press conferences. And again, his fight was 6th, 7th, 8th down on the card. But a young Conor McGregor would make his Boston debut on the show against Max Holloway, originally supposed to fight Andy Ogle, if you think of kind of how history works. And kind of interesting, you know, who knows what would have happened if Andy Ogle was in that fight. However, Max Holloway, the current featherweight king, took on Conor McGregor, who had there was all this hype behind him. And this was a unanimous decision victory for McGregor. But he blew out his knee in this fight and kind of blamed that. They remember feeling a little bit disappointed after this because there was so much hype, so much interest. And he just kind of, it was kind of a ho-hum three-round decision. But afterwards, we found out he would blow his knee out. But however, in the post-fight press conference, he was money in the bank. He was so
And that's
good.
With Chael Sonnen on the dais. Remember yes. that. Remember how you know, elite Chael was in that category at this time period after riding high, after choking Shogun in the main event and being the toast. He was the toast of the town that night because he remember he cut that post-fight promo where he basically like said, "You're watching Fox Sports 1," and he did it with the index finger for the one. And he was like, you know, he was like heaven sent from the marketing department to win that main event, and then went on to wear the suit and be the analyst at their desk for years before the steroid controversies and going to ESPN. But oh yeah. No, if you were there that night and you saw Conor be Conor, you know, I first saw him on that event when they did a screening of the premiere of what was to be the next season of Ultimate Fighter. It was the Ronda Rousey, Miesha Tate season. They did it at
Yeah, that's right.
Did you go to that?
I did. I forgot all about that.
A whole bunch of us were there, I remember. And so they screened it at the Boston Common Movie Theater. And Ronda was there to take questions. They did a Q&A and Miesha was there. And Conor McGregor, who, you know, you got to remember at the time, you know, certainly his Cage Warriors exploits had put him on the map for hardcore MMA fans. He had done a few Ariel Helwani shows and people realized that he was an incredibly engaging personality and had the gift of gab, to say the least, and kind of was a quirky guy. But to see him live it before anyone gave a shit about him. You know what I mean? To see him carry himself into that movie theater. I believe he had suspenders on and a bow tie, kind of like pants riding up high like capris would, but like a scowl, like carrying himself like he was ready to fight at any moment, but dressed like, you know, I don't know, dressed like
he went to Harvard.
Yeah, he was in tails, basically. I mean, he wasn't like in a suit per se, but yeah, he was dressed almost like a Goonies era paperboy or something like that. But it was like, but it was cool. You know, you could clearly tell it was fashion forward. It wasn't some kind of, you know, just strange quirk. You know, he was of the moment, but he was walking around with sunglasses indoors. Nobody was there, no cameras, nothing. With a couple of people with him, he came to the premiere, and this was just closed to press. This wasn't any kind of a public event. It's important to know. And, he's just like, I'm trying to describe it. Very like rigid, you know, his back set very straight, always in the kind of posture that he holds himself at a distance in an MMA fight, really, with kind of like a wider stance. I'll talk about this a bit later when we talk about when he fought Dennis Seaver in the headliner a few years later, and kind of some more sort of body language things I observed about him that still stick with me. But I'll never forget how he walked around like he had a vortex around him, like he was on a mission, but like nobody really knew how big of a deal he was going to be, although he certainly got more than the expected amount of hype for an undercard fight on that show. He talked hilariously in the press conference. Remember this? About parting the curtain in the Boston Garden, and the first thing he sees is a leprechaun in the crowd. Someone had dressed up like a leprechaun and was cheering wildly. They promoted his appearance heavily. I mean, Dana saw the writing on the wall immediately. Yeah. They actually thought Boston would be a great market considering the massive Irish population here for Connor. He only ended up fighting here once because only Vegas at a certain point could command the kind of dollars that made sense for him. But oh my God, they did like a poster contest here. Yes. We're like,
yes,
remember that? You
yes.
could submit Conor McGregor posters from around the city. And he was the guy. He was the face of that promotion in a lot of ways. You know, nationally, Chael was kind of the salesman for the card. And they had what ended up being Donald Cerrone versus Benson Henderson, originally to be Eddie Alvarez versus Benson Henderson. And they had some other important fights on that night. Uriah fought that night. They loaded it up because it was, as you said, the premier live event on Fox Sports 1 the very day that station went live. So, yeah, it was a banner night. But Connor, man, that was I completely relish and cherish the fact that I was there for that, because you saw the raw material before anybody realized that he could go on to make more money than any fighter ever had in terms of MMA. And who knows? I mean, if you extrapolate it out, combat sports in general, if you add up the dollars a certain way, I'm sure. And it was on display post-fight press conference. He's talking about how, you know, he's out here with this timepiece. Remember that?
Yes.
He had the time. He had the pocket watch, whatever the fuck it was. And he's like, you know, I got to pay for this. Like, I'm still in debt. You know, he's like, you know, I am dressed to the nines and I am bedazzled and all that. But he was like straight up about how he was going into debt dressing the part. I distinctly remember that. And him just taking over that press conference despite some really big names like Sonnen and Faber being up there.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you think back to, and I would urge anyone who has not seen this or has forgotten all about it, or did see it, forgot all about it, that I would go back and watch that post-fight press conference. It was just, it was, yeah, you're right. I could not, and none of us, I think, could have predicted that he would obviously be the guy to make $100 million fighting Floyd Mayweather in, less than 5 years later, which is crazy. 4 years later, even. That's just amazing. But just, you saw that there was, he made you take your eyes away from the center of the stage and look over a bit, be like, who is this guy over here? Like what, like
he yeah, was immediately, he's like at the far right.
Yeah. I remember that. Yeah. He was, there was something there for sure. And I forgot that he went to the, that tough screener, and it wasn't like, you know, that was next to the garden. That's a little ways away. So he had to go out of his way to do that. So even back then he just was always kind of, yeah, he's just kind of thinking and being around and being a presence and all that. And perhaps, I mean, who knows if he had any interactions with, you know, Rousey and Tate. Maybe he's just kind of trying to understand how that part of the system worked, so to speak. And
oh, yeah.
And the superstars and all that stuff. So
oh, yeah.
Clearly he was studying before he really knew kind of what he was studying to be.
Yeah, totally. It was great to see that. And, you know, later when he came through, they did a Boston stop on the McGregor-Aldo World Tour before the fight that ultimately was canceled for UFC 189. He came to Boston, and they did a press event at the in Dorchester. What the hell's the name of that theater? I feel bad forgetting it. And it was great. I mean, he had now commanded. He knew how to establish the command of the people, and it was the first time he came through for the Seaver fight, but you know, it was just like they did a Boston stop for him, and he knew how to say all the right things about this being his second home and the support of the Irish. You could see it in the crowd. You know, I used to joke that like you can tell the people that got on the plane to come here from Ireland versus the local Irish at a McGregor fight, because if they were Irish Americans from Boston, they were wearing hoodies, but if they were Irish from the old country, they were wearing track jackets or bubble vests.
Yeah.
That's the difference. But yeah, it was just something to see him come back and command the stage like he did. And that was really, you know, a lot of the highlight clips that made the final cut and that remarkable Aldo build, the kind of the craziest faces and the testiest face-offs that they did on that whole thing and grabbing the belt and everything. A lot of that actually happened on the Boston stop. That was absolutely electric. And it was great to see him come back from like we're talking about that kind of, glimpse that we got in 2013 when he fought Holloway in the undercard of what was to come, and just see him realize it. It was crazy. It was like one of those few times where everybody's like, this guy's going to be a star, and then he becomes a star. You know, so often we're like, this guy could be a star, and then when something goes wrong, we're just like, oh geez, that's what we get for thinking we can call these things. But Connor's the one guy who just exceeded expectations at every stop, and that's remarkable. That's something you don't forget when you see that kind of ascent.
14,181 saw the show that night. 1.534 million revenue at the gate. They priced these tickets right because they wanted to pack the Garden as much as possible, as they usually do with these big Fox shows and FS1 show. They want to have a festive atmosphere, and they put together a, like I mentioned, this was a really great card. A few things I remember leading into Fight Week. They had a media day, and they had the open workouts and so on at the Garden. And I remember for some reason, I had in my mind that Matt Brown was fighting John Howard on the show. And I remember asking John Howard about his style versus Matt Brown's style. And John just went kind of ahead and answered the question. And it wasn't until afterwards I realized, I'm like, you idiot. He is not fighting Matt Brown. He didn't. And it kind of re-illustrated to me, like, when you're asking some of these athletes questions, they're really not listening to you that much, or they listen to the very smallest part, and they're ready to kind of just spin off any type of verbiage back to you that kind of makes sense of what you're saying. But total. And I just was like, around my peers, I was just like, God, what a moron. But luckily, I was able to come back and, you know, do my thing. But however, it was one of those things I always remember of, like, I don't know why I thought they were fighting, but Matt Brown was fighting Mike Pyle, and John Howard was fighting Ryan Hall on that show. Let's see, other things. Conor McGregor week, as I mentioned, he was originally supposed to fight Andy Ogle. Tiago Alves was supposed to fight in the show, and he got injured, so Mike Pyle moved in against Matt Brown. Nick Ring, I know you're disappointed. You're not getting a chance to see Nick Ring fight in the Garden. He was out. Josh Saman was in. Then Josh Saman was out, and then John Howard got re-signed by the UFC to fight against Uriah Hall. And Akira Khorasani was out, and then Steven Seiler was in. And yeah, I forgot all about that Ronda Misha screening. That was fun. I mean, that was like, that was the 2-hour premiere, right? If I remember right.
Yeah, it was a 2-hour. Yep. And you know, they had done, since that was the first one for Fox Sports 1, they freshened up the look of the show. They did a much more kind of cinematic treatment. They started doing that thing where they put the fighters in front of that light that, like, basically projects the octagon onto their pupils. And there was like all kinds of marketing around it. And, you know, it was supposed to be a fresh coat of paint for the show, migrating over from Spike, where it had been for 14 seasons, to Fox Sports 1. There's a lot of enthusiasm in the air for that whole thing. I remember the Fox Sports lanyards all over the house that night, standing out on the floor, people who, you know, had executives at Fox Sports 1. I remember standing with some of them watching the main event, and how just over the moon they were that Chael not only got the first round submission, but cut that post-fight promo that basically put over the network as the new hot thing in sports, and I'm your man to lead the charge, Fox Sports 1, and he circled his index finger when he said 1. It was like, this is freaking incredible. It reminded me a lot of the Ultimate Fighter 1 finale. It really did, in a lot of ways. Not because it marked any kind of explosive period of growth, though certainly it did an incredible rating for a brand new network. I mean, that was the UFC really planting its flag in the ground anew, because there were some big questions about them going from Spike, which was, you know, kind of like a top 25 cable station where they had done appreciable numbers for years, and going to this no-name station that used to be the Speed Channel, much further down the dial. You know, kind of struggling to get acceptance, and the city was crawling with Fox PR people trying to, you know, gin up interest and press coverage of the show. I remember some of the Fox Sports 1 people, you know, going to dinner with them and, you know, doing pieces not only about the fighters, but about what this Fox Sports 1 thing was going to be and what the vision was about making inroads and creating a true challenge to ESPN in terms of a 24-hour sports network. There was all kinds of anticipation around the Fox Sports Live show and what was it, Onright and O'Toole? Is that their names from Canada that they hired?
Yes.
That was obviously short-lived. This was that disastrous early period where they'd bring on, like, forgive me for not saying the right people, but like Kobe to talk about baseball. And he would, you know, like sport, just athletes from other sports just to spit platitudes about, you know, these generics that apply to any sport you're talking about. And that's what they offered up as analysis. They had the Regis Philbin show, God help us.
Yes.
You know, they were just searching for a hook and an identity. But UFC was the stalwart on that station. They set out to build Fox Sports 1 around the UFC. They had the contract, which is coming due next year, just beginning to really set in and take shape. And man, did they more than come to define that network. I mean, that is the heart of Fox Sports 1. If they leave Fox Sports 1, their average goes down significantly. You know, unless we're talking if they manage a major league game, they have Major League Baseball, they have NASCAR on occasion that, you know, often does higher ratings than the UFC, but it's the consistency of output that we've seen since that first show in 2013 from Boston on Fox Sports 1 that has made that station at all a going concern. So it's going to be fascinating to see what happens if they leave, which it appears likely they will, and what becomes of FS1 after. But it all started that night, and Chael Sonnen. I remember Travis Brown knocking out Alistair Overeem. That was incredibly eventful. Classic Overeem, where he hurt someone with a shot to the body, like he hurt Stipe early in their fight, and then walks in with a knockout shot and ends up getting pummeled. Same thing happened to him, of course, against any number of opponents, Silva. And basically, the thing I remember about that was interviewing Travis Brown before the fight at the media day. They did remember they did media avails on the floor of the Garden?
Yes.
A day out? Yep. And I asked Travis Brown, you know, what to describe Alistair Overeem's striking style. And he said Dutch. And he said it in a way where that was supposed to be like a hint that the guard that he holds to protect his chin was kind of open for shots up the middle. And I kind of cobbled that together afterwards because I didn't really understand the significance of what he was saying at the time. And sure enough, Travis Brown went straight up the middle with that teep kick, putting the sole of his foot on Overeem's chin for a remarkable comeback after getting hurt badly with the body shot. That was so eventful. And I remember Chael Sonnen was riding the wave of controversy about TRT use. He was right in the thick of that, batting back questions. I remember going to the Athletic Commission meeting before the show where they sanctioned Chael and gave him the exemption to use TRT, and kind of like how uncomfortable and unused to it they were, that they were actually getting some degree of scrutiny. And you know who was there? Do you remember these guys? Do you remember the Culinary Union?
I do. Oh my God. Yes.
These are the memories are flooding back, Josh. I don't know if you intended to open up this Pandora's box, but it is happening right here at WrestlingObserver.com.
So we're going on a deep dive.
Yeah, that wasn't enough of a pause, but yes. and so, you know, everywhere Chael went, he had to get permission from the commission to use TRT, and they left this decision to like the Thursday before the show. It was like absolutely crunch time. And the Culinary Union, of course, in their fight to unionize station casinos for Tita Casinos in Las Vegas, were set up the Unfit for Children, UFC Unfit for Children website, this propaganda thing, Moms Against UFC, just bringing back all these 1994 arguments about why the sport shouldn't be allowed, and of course highlighting all of the domestic and criminal justice misdeeds. Anytime a fighter stepped out of line, they would highlight that and say that that's reflective of a problem endemic to the sport as opposed to the individuals, some individuals involved in it. So it was nasty. And they showed up at the Athletic Commission with the main event on the line. I mean, let's face it, if the commission didn't allow Chael to get that exemption, that main event is off. They had all kinds of issues with visas. I think Shogun made it, obviously, but there were a bunch of Brazilian fighters that were supposed to come in.
Yeah.
And there were processing problems with their visas. And there were real questions as to whether people would get to the show that we're supposed to. So there's all kinds of commission related melodrama, and the Culinary Union people, you know, 12, 15 strong out from Vegas are in with their rallying shirts and their posters, and they're standing in this cramped Athletic Commission meeting room, downtown Boston, just like standing there looking at the commission the whole time. And they're trying to kind of get fired. They're trying to get fired up about TRT. They barely even knew what the controversy was. They were just trying to stop the show.
Yeah.
And that pressure actually resulted in a local measure passing at the Boston City Council, which you may have forgotten about, that banned kids from the show. Do you remember that?
I kind of do, yeah.
There was this last minute push, and the council decided that anyone under 18 couldn't attend this event.
Nope. Yes, I do remember this now. Yeah. Yep.
And Dana took questions about it, was saying, you know, well, we're not going to come back here. I mean, if that's the kind of reception we got, but there was all the union pressure. You know, obviously unions tremendously politically influential in this town. I mean, they basically get what they want. And that night, that was kind of that event, that was kind of their way of dinging the UFC and the labor fight, was to get a measure passed that not only banned kids from the show, but created a round of unflattering headlines. And that was the whole goal. I remember meeting the organizer for that local after that meeting and just talking to him about it and asking him, like, you know, this is after Rampage had his problems with the car accident and hitting the pregnant woman. And I was like, you know, aren't you guys mad about Bellator too? Like, why is all your stuff mad about UFC. If MMA is your problem, why don't you ever mention some of the athletes of, you know, because they had tried to highlight Rampage's misdeeds when he was under UFC contract. And then when he went to Bellator, they didn't give a damn about Rampage anymore.
Right.
They didn't care about the moral outrage. So I thought that was revealing and fun, but they outlined the whole case they had about labor relations violations and station casinos. It was great that that whole Vegas Strip classic labor relations battle landed in our backyard just for a week. It was fun to watch and document.
A couple notable results, as you mentioned, Chael Sonnen submitting Shogun Hua. I remember that was quite a thing. He was, I remember this from an angle of, he was associated with, so at the time I was doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu at Henzo Gracie, New Hampshire. And there was a chance that Shogun was going to stop by during the week because he had an association with Henzo Gracie somehow in the school, and some of the other guys that was training with knew the owner of the school. And anyway, he didn't stop by, but I remember they were actually there that night. So I remember just thinking, oh boy, I wonder how this is going to go over at the school next week. And I believe Babalu actually stopped by the school that week. And I remember that was, I just remember that just knowing kind of who was going to be there and who was at the school during the week and all that stuff. It just kind of add a different element for me. And then for Chael Sonnen to submit him, I'm like, what irony there. Right. You mentioned Travis Brown, obviously the kick from hell, going through that popped the crowd big. Uriah Faber on that show, the Matt Brown, Mike Pyle fight ended in 30 seconds. I remember Mike Pyle just laying flat on the canvas after Matt Brown knocked him out. The John Howard, Uriah Hall fight, which was horrendously boring. John Howard trying a video game punch to the canvas at the end of the fight, and it was just not very good at all. And then Michael Johnson, and unfortunately for Joe Lauzon, not having hit the anywhere near the moment as when he first fought in the Garden, Michael Johnson taking him out and as to open up the main card. Michael McDonald versus Brad Pitt was on the show. We mentioned they actually won Fight of the Night. Conor McGregor, Max Holloway, we talked about. And then a few other guys are still competing. Owen St. Preux fought early on this show. I believe this might have been his first UFC fight or one of his early UFC fights, knocking out Cody Donovan. James Vick was on the show, and some other notable names here and there. Again, McDonald, Pickett, Fight of the Night. Brown and Brown, each winning knockout of the night. Dana was happy on this night. To give out a bunch of bonuses. Michael McDonald.
Oh, yeah. Chael Sonnen. What a home run.
Yeah. They both got submission in the nights. And this was a long night. I remember that press conference was very late. I put down 1 a.m. I think it might have even been later than that. We were all packed into this very small room, tight chairs. I'm like, is there no other room that we can go to? Everything was just totally, solely tight. And I remember on that night, Jeff Wagenheim looked at me and complimented the fact that I had a suit on at the event, as he is known as the man in the shirt. So I always remember that. And that was, that was a very fun night. I remember it was just from start to finish with the McGregor week. Everything that was just a very satisfying show and a very satisfying week, and the UFC really needed it.
They did. And they, like I said, I think the most significant thing historically is how they performed for Fox Sports 1 that night. I mean, I think they did 1.8 million on a station no one ever heard of. I mean, that blew away the entertainment world. I mean, I remember there was like people who didn't know the first thing about UFC, who understood the television business, who really had trouble wrapping their heads around how a first night a station could do that kind of rating and what that said about the potential of UFC to move eyeballs. It's a lot like WWE in that, you know, when they went from USA to Spike got a sensational boost. People followed them. People followed SmackDown from UPN to CW to My Network to Sci-Fi. You know, I mean, certainly the audience whittled away slightly over all those years, but they came right out of the gate and brought double the viewers that they could expect on average in some of these lesser stations. And the UFC is just that property as well, and was that night for Fox.
All right. Big thanks to Jack for stopping by. Again, that was part one, and we will get with part two tomorrow. A couple other notes as we talk to you on a very snowy Wednesday. Let's see. So Dana White was on Toucher and Rich, which is a local local sports show, a morning show on the 98.5, which is the sports hub, which is one of the top two radio stations in the region when it comes to sports. Actually, number two behind WEEI for the most part. However, he's on Touch and Rich. A lot of people heard the interview with Dana White this morning, where he was kind of, you know, talking about, they asked him a lot of Connor questions and so on. And one of the guys kind of sat in, I think he's an intern or might be a producer on the show or something, happened to ask, he knows a lot about MMA, you can tell, asked about Khabib versus Tony Ferguson and kind of what that's happening with that. And Dana White answered and said, it's a go, kind of to paraphrase it. We're looking at getting that fight for UFC 223 in Brooklyn, New York in April. So it looks like that could be a go. And it was not announced if that's going to be for the interim lightweight title or if Connor's going to actually drop the lightweight title. They're going to strip him of that. And basically said Connor can't hold up the division. So, you know, take that for what it's worth. So looks like we could be seeing that fight. They've been trying to make that three separate times now, and maybe we'll actually get to see that in April. I believe it when both guys actually walk out to the cage at this point. The fight seems to be snake bitten, but someday they're going to make it, and it looks to be in April. Let's see what else. No other real notes. They're doing a media day at Fenway Park today. They're doing open workouts tomorrow, or maybe I may have that actually reversed, but yeah, it's the weather is causing a little bit of some travel issues today, but they're doing an event of a Fenway Park, and then obviously the weigh-ins on Friday leading into the show on Saturday. I will be there, of course, so if you happen to be around, say hi. Let's see. I think that's about it, really kind of UFC-related. Again, kind of fun topics there, talking about 118. And I asked Brian and Dave if they remembered anything about the show. I haven't heard anything from Brian yet, or sorry, from Dave yet. Brian had no recollection of the show at all. He said virtually nothing, asked me to jog his memory. He said, I went to so many UFCs back in the day, they all blend together. So that's, Brian does not remember anything about that that weekend at all. No big surprise there. So we'll call it good there for today. So again, big thanks to all you guys for listening. Thanks to Jack. Join us for part two tomorrow, where we will get into Dillashaw versus Cruz and also the very first main event in Conor McGregor's history, Conor McGregor versus Dennis Seaver, and we'll talk a little about UFC 220, the card itself, including some very interesting thoughts that Jack had about what happens if that Stipe Miocic might actually be the potential biggest winner coming out of this whole weekend. So look for that tomorrow. This has been Josh Nace's Punch Out, and until next time, insert catchphrase here.